Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This show originally aired on the Premier Network on Saturday, April 21st, 2018. This is episode 1481. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/techguy. And by LastPass, join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Do it the right way at lastpass.com/twit. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Time to talk computers, the internet, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, your smartwatches, your augmented reality, your real reality, your virtual reality, all that stuff. 888-ASK-LEO is my number. 888. Oh, you know what? I tell you what. I'm not going to give out the number again. We don't need calls today because I'm not here. I am a ghost, a phantom. I'm actually on vacation. But we did record a whole new show. This is a brand new show. No one's ever heard this show ahead of time so that you'd get a fresh show. But there's no point in calling. Next weekend, we will have Rich DeMuro from KTLA. He'll be in here. You could call him. And I'll be back taking your calls May 6th. May 6th when I'll be back from vacation. However, we do have news. Did you file your taxes? It was tax day on Tuesday, right? Except that the IRS was down. The e-file was down for a good part of the day. Now, I don't think the IRS has said what happened, but that's a little weird. Some would say, no, it's not weird because this is the busiest day of the year. But yeah, okay, true. But the IRS knew that. Excuse me. I talk about taxes. I get my allergies kick in. The IRS knew that you were going to be calling, come a calling, on April 17th. They knew that. But for some reason, boom, they went down. Yeah, a lot of people using software do that e-filing. I do the e-filing. The companies that do software filing are sponsor TurboTax, H&R Block, not our sponsor, and others. IRS Direct Pay, which is right through the IRS, all unable to file electronically. TurboTax told me that they were taking the files, the tax returns, and holding them. You would upload to them, and then you'd be done. And then as soon as the IRS came back on, which it did, they uploaded it. It's a lot of returns that get filed electronically. This is a sea change. Do you remember tax years past where you would, for those of you who still do your own returns, and I think that's a dwindling number only because taxes have gotten so complicated. But do you remember printing out, maybe you use software, maybe you went to the post office, got forms and hand filled it out, put it all in a big envelope, and go to the post office on April 15th, right? In fact, our post offices in this area and in many areas would stay open late till midnight. They'd have postal workers standing by the mailboxes. Some of them would have coffee and donuts. It was a kind of a national holiday, except it's nothing to celebrate. Well, that's changed so much thanks to technology. Last year, 87% of individual returns were filed electronically. 152 million returns. 87%. And what the IRS says is you get refunds faster. It's easier. You're less likely to have an error, less likely to get lost in the mail. The IRS loves it. They like e-file also because they don't have to key it in. In the old days, the bad old days when people sent in returns, paper returns, they had to hire people to enter those. Imagine. Entering almost 200 million tax returns. That's not a negligible cost. So the IRS loves e-file. But given that they knew that I don't know how many of the 87% are fall on the last day possible, but I would guess it's probably more than half, right? How many people really get their taxes done ahead of time? Mine were done ahead of time, but I waited till the deadline because I just wanted to make sure, check it again, you know, don't send it before you have to. And the whole idea of e-file is, well, you push a button and it's done. It's speed of light, except it wasn't. So the IRS knew that they were going to be getting some people visiting. You can buy bandwidth to handle that kind of thing. I know. I'm really curious. I wonder, honestly, I wonder if they were under attack. They would never say. If they were, they wouldn't say it. Wouldn't give them the satisfaction. The IRS did say if you know, the systems are down and you file late, that's okay. You won't be penalized. There'll be at least a little bit of a reprieve. I think you probably, if you haven't filed, you should probably file now. I wonder, did anybody print theirs out and go to the post office? Do people even have a printer anymore? E-file is it. Now, one of the things that's changed also, not only the fact that we file electronically, but of course we do everything on the internet, and bad guys have gotten very clever and aggressive about attacking on the internet. And one of the things bad guys do, and it's one of the reasons I'm always beating this drum of secure your system, be very careful, don't, you know, keep your system up to date, don't download files from strangers, don't click on links you don't know, don't open email attachments. I say this all the time, and I'm not just, you know, beating my gums for fun. It's really important, and it's not just for you. Of course, that's a big part of it, but it's for the internet ecosystem as a whole. Because when your computer is co-opted, it's often used to attack other computers. And one of the scams we know about that's been happening for some time, organized crime uses these co-opted computers. There have been a number of these viruses, hundreds, thousands probably, that you get on your system, you don't even know it's there. You know, the really bad ones, they don't want you to know you have a virus. They want you to keep operating like normal. And you'd think at first, oh, yeah, they're probably just trying to get my credit card number or something. No, you know what? You're small potatoes. Sorry, but you are. What for us done a lot is that your computer joins what's called a botnet. And I've seen these. I remember seeing the first botnet 15 years ago and watching it populate as more and more computers were co-opted by malware. They put a little, you can't, again, it's completely, you're not aware of it. It's completely invisible to you. But your computer joins into a chat room and says, and waits there, says, what is thy will, my master? And just waits there, sits there. And then the bad guy has access to hundreds of thousands of machines he can attack with. And so the scam, the organized crime scam, is they go, this very popular to go to, let's say, off-track betting sites, you know, gambling sites, the day before the Kentucky Derby. It would be a shame if something were to happen so that on Derby Day you couldn't take any bets the day before the Super Bowl. It would be a crime. However, my firm is willing to protect you for a small fee. What the bad guys really say, it's the old protection racket, right? The bad guys really saying, and these companies know this, we're going to attack you. We're going to bring your site down. It's called a distributed denial of service attack, and we have several hundred thousand machines that are going to take your site down on Derby Day or on Super Bowl Day, and you won't be able to take any bets, and you're going to lose lots of money. So give us a little money, 100,000 here, 200,000 there, a million here, and we'll protect you. It's the oldest play in the book, just now with a digital gloss. What makes this even worse is, you no longer really have to commandeer 100,000 or 200,000 computers to be effective in this. There's something called amplification attacks that a little guy, a little kitty hacker who has, you know, a regular connection to the internet, a few megabits upstream, normally not enough to do this by himself, can use amplification attacks, can send messages. This is what happened last year when DYN was brought down. They send messages out that get other machines to attack with an amplification. You send one packet out and the machine responds with thousands of packets. And this is also very common. So we may never know what happened. I'd be very curious. But I have to think the IRS, which can afford and is, you know, would be behooved to have lots of bandwidth on tap for tax day, either didn't, which would be bad, or, and I think this is more likely, maybe it was under attack. Do you think we'll ever know? Hey, let's get to the phones. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Time to talk high tech right after this. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and let's get to the phones, starting off with Ryan in Anaheim, California. Hi, Ryan.
Leo Laporte, how you doing?
I am well. Thanks for hanging on. What can I do for you?
I've been waiting to talk to you for a while. Hopefully you'll put me on the air, because last time when you went on vacation, you had to edit me out. I was never on.
Oh, man. Well, just ask the same question. And
we were talking about Butterbeer, but I think you forgot.
Oh, it was great. You know what? They probably went on too long, so they had to snip it a little bit. So I apologize. But
I have to tell you about my experience with Samsung.
Okay.
I have a Samsung Galaxy S6 Edge that expanded and exploded.
Oh, my.
I sent it back, and then they returned it, and then I sent it back, and I returned it, and then I got it back. And I called corporate, and I found their number.
When the second time you sent it back, what was wrong with this the second time?
The same thing.
Was it a new phone, do you know, or was it the same phone?
It was the same phone.
They just didn't fix it.
They didn't fix it. They just took one look at it and then sent it back.
You know, that's really surprising because, as you probably know, and Samsung has learned, expanding lithium-ion batteries are very dangerous because the pressure that they can go under then can cause them to burn or explode. So, in fact, if you tell a company that I have a device, whether it's Apple or a laptop manufacturer or phone manufacturer, that is swelling because of the battery, they will often send you a special box, a fireproof box, and require you to ship it via ground only because it's so dangerous. Now, when was this that happened? Was it before the Note 7?
I told them I had the Note 7. I sent it back. I said, if I burnt my hand with either one, you wouldn't give me a problem. And then as soon as I mentioned the iFixit and I mentioned you, Leo Laporte, they basically put me on hold and said, okay, we'll exchange your phone. I sent them the bill of sale, and I'm like, I know Leo Laporte. You don't have any parts to fix it. They have them on Amazon for like $12, but I'm not voiding my warranty. And
you shouldn't have to, because that's their problem, not yours.
Right, and I said, how can I expand my battery? And I said, I wasn't the original owner. And I kept saying the right to fix it.
That's where they get off the hook, because you're not the original owner. And some companies will not extend the warranty to aftermarket resales. That's how they got off the hook. But it's a real problem, because that's a danger to you, your family, your house.
Right. And I just kept fighting them over and over and over again.
Good.
And I wasn't going to back down.
Good.
I know Leo. I got Leo on my back.
Good for you. You can use anybody. You can use my name anytime in something like that.
I did. I told them. I'll go on national radio. I don't care.
Yeah.
I said, I took it to U-Break iFix. They said, we'll take care of it. Then the U-Break iFix called me and said they wanted me to come send it back. I'm like, no, I'll have Samsung send you a mail because I'm not going to drive all the way there to go behind your building to send it back to UPS. I'm not doing this. I didn't damage my phone. I told them that 100 times. Like, well, it's just standing on the phone.
Bottom line, because I don't want you to get it added out again, but bottom line, they did fix it eventually, but it just was a big fight.
Well, yeah, because I had to email them my bill of sale, but then it's like I haven't got my phone yet because it takes a couple of days. But after, you know, calling them all week long, not giving up and kept saying, you know, you're breaking the law. You don't give me parts to fix it. That's not fair.
Good.
And, you know, they were just, they're brutal. I mean, they're literally, I have the Note 8, but I got
Now, the good news is now the S9, they have contracted with iBreak UFix, and they say that they will, I mean, I hope that this is true, because that's not a normal thing to have broken. A swelling phone with a battery is, as we said, very dangerous. So that's even, that requires an above and beyond response, not simply the normal, well, you didn't buy it. Maybe we're not going to fix it. The warranties doesn't cover it, et cetera, et cetera. I'm glad you got some satisfaction, though. I'm sorry it was so hard to do it. And I'm glad you called me to let people know. Are you going to get it? Will you get another Samsung phone?
No. I mean, I have the
This is, by the way, this is where Apple really has the upper hand. Now, of course, there's always going to be people who have problems. You know, if you have 100 million phones out there, people are, you know, even a small percentage of people is enough to sound like a lot. But Apple in general is very good about this. And because they have retail outlets right there in town, in many cases, it's a lot. It's just, you know, you can go to your local Apple store and get some satisfaction. And I think that that is a strong argument for Apple. I love my Samsung S9 Plus. I think it's one of the best phones I've ever used. I'm really impressed by it. I have a Note 8 as well. I like that an awful lot, too.
Oh, yeah.
But if service and support is important, even for other devices like laptops, there's Apple's second to none. And this is this is smart of them. They charge more.
They
do. You pay $200 more for that iPhone, but at least you're going to get good support.
Well, I told them that I have the Axon 7 for Leo Report's recommendation, and I said if I crack it, then I spend another $400. Why would I damage my phone? And I said not only that, I said my S6 still works. You plug it in and watch it with, you know, Chromecast, and then you unplug it, it dies because the battery expanded. It's like they don't understand. How would I do that? It exploded. They just don't get it. They're like, well, you broke it. No, I didn't.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry that you had this, but I'm glad that you were able to get some satisfaction in the end. And, you know, this is, frankly, all devices have problems. All computers have problems. All software. Problems are not the benchmark. The benchmark is how a company responds to problems. I will only say it's a good company if they respond quickly and appropriately to the customer problems. Now, one thing we all have to understand, it's less so in phones. I think we're paying a premium for phones, but at least in computers and PCs, one of the ways they've got the prices down, computers are so inexpensive these days. One of the things that happens when you get prices down that low is you stop good service and support. You can't afford it anymore. And that's what we're seeing in the PC world. I don't think there's an excuse in the phone world because I think the markup on phones is pretty darn good. I think Samsung, they're selling the S9 Plus for $720, S9 for $720, S9 Plus for $840. They're making a few $100 on a phone, at least, right? They're making enough that I think we deserve good service and support. On the other hand, you buy a $400 laptop, you can't expect to call and get decent phone service, you know, because every time you call, you're basically eating away at the profit margin. And I don't blame the companies. We demanded cheaper computers. We got them. But we also have to understand, you know, we're not going to get the best support. That's why, frankly, an Apple computer, an Apple phone, they sell at a premium. A significant amount of that premium goes to providing better than usual service and support. And a lot of it goes to profit. they have a pretty healthy margin. I don't remember the last Apple quarterly report, but I seem to remember their profit margins are in the 35 to 40% range. After all's in, that's pretty darn good. I would be happy to have 10% profit in my little company. 40%, man. No wonder they're the number one most capitalized, what are they, almost a $1 trillion company now. They're getting close. The most valuable company in the history of mankind. Hey, thanks. I appreciate the call. I'm glad you got some solution, Ryan. I appreciate it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll get back to the phones in just a second. Oh, my, Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and that strange music. We never did figure out why that is your theme song, did we, Scott?
We never did, no.
That strange music. I'll have to ask Michael someday. Michael Cozio probably is the guy who picked it. Or maybe his predecessor. It's been your theme for a long time, yeah.
And I had nothing to do with choosing it, believe me.
That's Scott Wilkinson. He's our home theater geek. Joins us each week to talk about big screen TVs, surround sound. You know, I wanted to ask you because I think it was last week or the week before, a guy was talking about his marriage.
Not sure I can help there.
Yeah. Well, he said, look, my wife, when we moved to Kansas, said I could build a man cave, and I spent a lot of money. He did. He spent a lot of money, built a very nice man cave with many of the devices we have recommended over the years, including that beautiful LG 4K OLED and all that.
But then they
realized after a couple of years in the house, they really wanted a TV in the living room, too. But he spent all his money. So he hasn't told his wife yet, but he got a Samsung 60-inch TV, very nice TV for the living room. But he says, I can't buy the surround sound like I got for my man cave. I want to get a sound bar, and budget's important. Now, I may have taken your name in vain here, Scott. Because I said to him, well, I think Scott recommends, for the lowest cost, the Vizio sound bars, right? You like those.
You are correct.
Yeah.
That is correct.
And they even have
was not taken in vain.
Like $90. I mean, they're very inexpensive, although you'd probably want to spend a little more and get a subwoofer, I think, for any sound bar.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely right. There are some sound bars that advertise, oh, you don't need a subwoofer. We've got a subwoofer built in. But, you know, as Scotty on Star Trek always says, you cannot change the laws of physics.
Is it he who says that?
It is he who says that.
I have to remember that because I actually use that quote a lot. So, and yeah, because the speakers on a soundbar are like a few inches. They're huge.
They're small.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you cannot move the amount of air at the low frequencies that a subwoofer really needs to be able to reproduce. So I never buy the marketing of, oh, we've got a subwoofer built in, you don't need one. Yes, you do, if you want that impact. Now, subwoofers are generally, because of the laws of physics, they're generally a little bit on the larger side. And, you know, the wife acceptance factor, the spousal acceptance factor, which we often talk about, comes into play there because it's a big black box sitting in the living room and the wife or the spouse may not want it there. Well, Vizio actually has an interesting solution to that problem, which is a subwoofer that is pretty narrow and in fact is designed to fit under the couch. So, you know, there's
no... You can put it under the couch?
You can. You can. That's what it's designed to do. Not only will it give you low frequencies, but it might also give you a bit of a shake in the
butt rumble. Now, the other one I mentioned to him, which comes with a subwoofer and is not much more expensive, kind of more a little more mid-range, I think it was $300, is the Polk Audio, and that comes with a sub. And you like that one too, right?
Absolutely. Okay. Polk makes great stuff.
I think they were bought by, I want to say, I know Cambridge Soundworks was bought by Logitech. I want to say.
No. Polk D&M? Is now owned. No. Well, yeah. D&M and Polk and Definitive Technology are all owned.
Samsung.
No. By a company called Sound United.
I'll stop guessing. Okay. Sound United. Okay.
Sound United is the company that owns all of those brands. And, you know, they're all very good. Denon and Marantz are among my favorite receivers. And Polk is one of the great, and Definitive Technology too, some of the great speaker companies for mid-range, you know, very, very high quality, but good value speakers. But the soundbar situation is Vizio at the low end, Polk certainly at the mid-range. Sony has some that are quite high end, you know, you can pay $1,500, $2,000. We have the
Sonos, which are overpriced because it's the Sonos functionality, but they sound nice. And the nice thing about them is you can have wireless surrounds because Sonos is all wireless, and wireless sub. So we do have that in one of the rooms. It's in the gym.
very good.
Yeah.
I have to put a caveat here, which is that when you say a wireless surround or wireless sub, that is true. Except for the fact that they still need to be plugged into a wall outlet. They require power because they have an amplifier built in and a radio receiver for receiving the audio signal. So it's not 100% wireless because you still need to plug it into an outlet. But other than that, yes, they're wireless. Nice thing about Vizio soundbars as well, and some other companies as well, including Sonos, as you mentioned, you can buy a soundbar with wireless surrounds as well as a wireless sub. The first thing to get to make sure of is a wireless sub, even if you don't put surrounds. And in the living room of this guy, may very well be that he will not be allowed to put surround speakers.
No. He said that's right out.
That's a no-no. Yeah.
But a subwoofer's- I mentioned Sonos because, I think that's very flexible. But he said we already have, and I said you might be able to convince your wife that the multi-room audio, which is the real reason you get Sonos, she might like that. And that's the reason we have that in the gym is because more often than watching TV, we're listening to music via streaming, Sonos internet.
Right.
And so, but he said, no, I already do that. And I think this is going to be more and more the case with Echoes, and Echoes now play multi-room music perfectly well. So, I have a feeling that that's not an option. But I think for the Polk for $300, including a subwoofer, you think the audio is decent on that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, I'm looking at our best soundbars of 2017 and the Polk Magnify Mini.
That was it.
Is the least expensive of the ones we recommend.
And it comes with
mini,
a
soundbar.
Because it's not a soundbar that goes the whole length of the TV. It's just a little speaker.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
What about now, center sound? So surround sound has left and right like stereo, but there's one in the middle that's usually voices. That's the center speaker.
But the dialogue, very important. Critically important.
And you may have some surround speakers and a subwoofer too. But how does it handle the center channel?
Oh, very well.
Is it separate?
Well, it's not separate. No, it's
often not a separate speaker. It's in that bar.
No, it's part of the bar. You know, a sound bar really is a bar, and it has speakers on either end and usually speakers in the middle as well.
So the center comes out of the center speakers in the sound bar. Okay.
Correct.
Because that's one problem. If you have a left-right stereo system and center often gets garbled because it's not coming from a separate speaker. So
that's correct.
But a soundbar does it properly.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Generally speaking, that is true.
That's good.
Now you can get something called virtual surround, in which the soundbar kind of simulates the effect of surround speakers without there actually being speakers back there. Yamaha is particularly good at that. So I would take a look, for example,
next step up. Yamaha has some great soundbars.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Now the YAS-207, which we reviewed and gave a good review to, is $300.
Okay.
The Polk Minify is Magnify is $250.
So I guess the point is that you don't just get a sound bar because you want something compact. You might also, if your budget is limited, get a sound bar.
Exactly.
Because you're going to get decent audio, certainly better than on TV audio.
Oh, no question about it. I always recommend, look, when you're buying a TV, if you're not buying a separate sound surround system with an AV receiver and speakers all around and so on, get a sound bar by all means. Anything you get is going to be better than those TV speakers.
And if you can afford to get a subwoofer or it comes with a sound bar, that's a great solution because those bass notes, just the sound bar just can't move those. But having a bass, and in the Magnify's case, the Polk's case, it's wireless. In some cases, it'll be wired. Does make a huge difference in the overall quality. It gets it a lot closer to a real surround system.
Huge difference.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's, definitely.
Thank you. I didn't take your name in vain. I thought I might have.
Nope.
Scott Wilkinson's editor at avsforum.com, a great place to read everything about audio and video, and his soundbar reviews are up there too, avsforum.com. Thanks, Scott.
My pleasure.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go on line two. I've got Dennis from Oceanside, California. Hi, Dennis.
Leo, let me get you off a speakerphone.
Yes, thank you. Welcome to the show. Thanks for holding on.
Well, thank you. I'm a longtime listener and a second-time caller.
All right.
I talked to you a couple of years ago about a different issue. But I want to upgrade my much older HP laptop. It's the only laptop that I use, and it's the HP G62. It's I always have a bunch of numbers after that.
I don't need all of that. But
Anyway... I want to, listening to your show, and especially today where you were saying that computers, there's nothing magic about it. It's a box of parts. I want to upgrade it to a solid-state drive before my hard drive fails.
Good. Yes, good thinking.
And I want to double the amount of RAM on the board to what the maximum manufacturer says for my model.
Fantastic. I think both of those are worthy upgrades. Even in an older computer, This computer is old enough that it came with 3 gigs of RAM. Is that what you still have?
No, I upgraded originally. Mine has 4 gigs of RAM, okay. And it had a 300 gig hard drive.
Oh, those were the days, my friends.
Yes, yes.
So an SSD will help almost any computer. It helps it more if you have a fast bus on the computer.
Okay.
And that's so you'll see some benefits. The reason a solid-state drive is faster, for a couple of reasons. One is, it's flash memory. It's the same kind of memory you put in a camera, or random access. So one of the things that slows spinning hard drives down is the fact that once you read a bit of data, you have to wait for it to come around again, the spinning of the drive. That's why faster drives are usually spin faster, for the data to come around again to read the second gulp of data. That's called drive latency. There's zero latency in an SSD. Everything's random access. All the data anywhere on the drive is equally accessible, and it's accessible very, very fast. So reads especially are very fast on a solid-state drive. Writes benefit a little bit from that, but they're not benefiting quite as much because they still have to write to the solid-state memory.
Okay. I've really not experienced any problem with mine, but it's starting to get slower and slower, and this is the original hard drive came with it 8 years ago.
So getting a solid-state drive will speed it up. Because the bus isn't as fast, even though solid-state drives can push a lot of data down the pipe, your pipe is narrow. It's not going to push as much, so you won't see as much performance improvement. It's probably, I'm thinking, I'm going to have to look here, SATA connectors. Nevertheless, as long as you get the right the drive that's right for that computer, you said Kim that you went to Crucial to get the stuff?
Yes, I went to the Crucial website after listening to you a couple of weeks ago when you were talking about this, upgrading older computers.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do this before my hard drive failed. I'm backing up my data.
So you were able to find a drive that they say this fits your HP. Good news.
They plug in the numbers and they say it'll take this much RAM, this size drive, and you should buy this one and this one.
Good.
That's what I did.
Fantastic. Now, RAM, it can go up to what, 8 gigs?
Eight.
Is that right?
Eight, yes.
Well, that's a big improvement. That's fantastic.
Oh, good.
That's great. You'll notice no matter what kind of computer, no matter what kind of RAM, going from 4 to 8, you should notice a speed bump. So you're doing the two best things you can do. You can't replace the CPU. It's not a super fast CPU, but you can't replace that. So you're kind of stuck with that. I think, chances are good you're going to get a nice system. You know, some of the benefit will be just from reinstalling the operating system on that new hard drive.
Oh, yeah, right.
That speeds up things a lot. Are you going to put Windows 7 on it?
I'm running Windows 7. I'm very comfortable with it.
Yeah,
I like
stick with it.
Everything it does, good. So I'm going to stick with it.
Good. I think that sounds about right.
Now, Crucial also provides software that you download and when you're getting ready to do this install. And it is a cloning software.
Yes. Almost all the hard drive companies will give you a program that does a bit-for-bit copy. It doesn't care what the operating system is. It doesn't care anything. It just goes boom, 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 exact clone. Take advantage of that. It's a little tricky with a laptop because you have to somehow – you can do it on a desktop easily. You put the new drive in, clone it, take the old drive out. A laptop, you can't have two drives at once, so it's a little trickier.
Well, they have a deal that you connect using the USB port.
Perfect.
To the SATA.
Perfect.
And while the hard drive is still running the computer, you can plug it in to the new SSD.
Perfect.
And it makes a clone, supposedly.
Take advantage of that.
Okay.
And chances are if you had Windows 7 and you still have that Windows 7 serial number.
Uh-huh, yes.
That the changing the drive and upgrading the RAM will not trigger any problems, that it'll just be a reinstall of Windows and everybody will be happy. I don't think you'll have any problems.
Okay. My question is, since I'm doing both, do you suggest...
By the way, 64 gig Windows 7, the chat room's reminding me, if you use 32-bit, it won't see any more than 4 gigs of RAM. You did get...
I have the 64.
Okay, very good.
And I think that's part of the Crucial website. It knows all that.
That's why I love that. Yep.
That's what it suggests.
Very nice.
I back up my my data and onto a flash or whatever. And then would you suggest that I install the new RAM, get everything running fine, back up the data again, and then go for the solid state? Or should I just go for everything at once?
Well, I guess from
incremental, probably.
Yeah, I guess from a practical point of view, it's better to do one at a time. But boy, it's a pain to reopen it all and everything. Here's what I would do: just put in the RAM first. Don't completely close up the case. Just put it on. Don't screw anything in.
Okay.
Make sure it boots up. Everything's fine.
Yes. Okay.
Then put in the new hard drive. That kind of is half and half.
Okay. I wanted to know: are there any specialized tricks that you would advise that is something that people go, oh, I got hung up on that? Or I'd also heard that once this is all in and running, you should turn off your disk fragmenter if you have that on automatic.
It's funny. Yeah, you don't need to do it, obviously, because as I mentioned, one of the benefits of solid state is it's random access. So
right.
There's no fragmentation that happens. But here's a strange side effect of optimization, of defragging.
Okay.
And I would never have thought this, but my friend Alan Malventano, who is my absolute guru on solid state drives, says that on older operating systems, Windows 7 is one of them, and older systems, it isn't a bad idea maybe once a year to run defrag, not because anything's fragmented, but because it will trigger something called trim. It will trigger a trim operation. Mm. The one thing that kind of slows SSDs down a little bit over time, and it's not a significant slowing. In fact, I remember I was at a CES one year, and I had two Intel engineers. They made SSD drives and made the best SSD drives. And they, both from the SSD labs themselves, were arguing between themselves on whether trim was important, whether SSDs made any difference on SSDs. I think it does make a little bit of difference, but they couldn't agree. The reason is the garbage collection on SSDs is imperfect. Modern operating systems, modern hardware has a thing called trim that will, in effect, refresh the drive and improve the speed. You can trigger it without having it supported in the operating system by running. This is kind of weird, and I'm trusting Alan on this, running a defrag. So if you notice your SSD after, and you shouldn't do it more than once a year, but after a year, if you notice it, don't certainly turn off the automatic defrag. But if you notice it after a year, go ahead, defrag.
You say do turn off the automatic defrag?
Yeah, you don't want to wear out the drive, that's for sure.
Okay, very good. And should I, speaking of defrag, would it be best to defrag the hard drive that's in the unit prior to this install?
Nope. Okay. Nope. No need.
Okay, no need.
Have fun. Good luck.
Thank you so much, Leo. I really enjoyed listening to
you. Chat room says you'll be calling again next week. I don't think so. I feel confident Dennis is going to do this great. Thank you, Dennis.
Okay, thank you, Leo.
All right. The website where all of this is detailed, techguylabs.com. More to come. Stay right here. Hey, our podcast today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. I love Rocket Mortgage. I love Quicken Loans. I do. Quicken Loans, the best lender in the country. Don't have to say that myself. J.D. Power says it. Number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years in a row for mortgage origination. Mortgage servicing, too. But they're also the most popular lender in the country. And I think that has something to do with Rocket Mortgage. See, Quicken Loans realized the lending process, the home loan process, the refi process was really kind of mired in the, you know, 19th century, I want to say 18th century, practically. Back in the good old days when you had to go to a bank to get a home loan and you had to, you know, put on a tie and a nice outfit and go down there and say, please, sir, can I have some money, and fill out a long application. And then, of course, your troubles had just begun, because now you have to go to the attic or the basement and go through the paperwork and find your old check stubs and your old bank statements, all that old stuff. And then, they had them in the 80s, you have to find a fax machine. Remember fax machines? And fax it into the bank. Amazingly, most home loans still work this way, but not Quicken Loans, not Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage is an entirely reinvented, technologically sophisticated, customer-focused reinvention of the home loan process. First of all, you don't have to go to the bank. You don't have to go anywhere. You can do it on your phone, on your laptop, on your computer, on your tablet. You can do it on all you need is a browser. And rocketmortgage.com/techguy. You go there, you answer a few questions you don't even have to look up the answers to. You know, name, address, birth date, that kind of thing. Then, because Quicken Loans has partnerships with all the big financial institutions, they do the rest. You say, go ahead, I'll give you permission. Get my information. They crunch the numbers based on your income, your assets, your credit. They say, here's the loans for which you qualify. You choose the down payment. You choose the rate. You choose the term. You get the loan. And all of that. Minutes. It's so fast because it's computerized, right? You could do it at the open house. You could say, well, let's buy this and go through the whole process, and before you leave, show the realtor we're approved. We're approved. They even have a button for those folks still living in the 19th century. The button that says print out the loan approval letter. Quicken Loans, you did it again. It's Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Go to rocketmortgage.com/techguy. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. rocketmortgage.com/techguy. We thank Rocket Mortgage for making the Tech Guy podcast possible. I am Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. And let's see, we've got many, many phone calls. People hanging on for dear life, like Dennis in Connecticut. Thank you for your patience, Dennis.
Yes, hello, how are you?
I am great, how are you?
Good, good, thanks.
What can I do for you to this fine day?
This might be a simple question.
Oh, I hope so. I'm praying for a simple question.
A Canon printer MX922 replaced all the ink cartridges and is not doing anything for us.
Yeah. Now, you've been through the maintenance menu, right, on this thing?
I don't even have a manual for it. I tried looking up the manual. Actually, it's my wife was messing around with it.
Okay. And, so, a couple of questions. Does this one have a front panel with an LCD or not?
Yes.
It does. All right. If you browse around on the LCD, maybe look for a lot of times it's a wrench and a gear. Look for a settings menu. There'll be a maintenance menu in there. And there's a couple of things. Inkjet printers can fail in a variety of ways. The most common is if you don't use it very often, the ink in the nozzles dries out and it clogs it. And now usually that means you're going to get some printing, but it'll be weird. Like some colors will be missing. Some dots will be missing. You're not getting anything. It's not responding at all?
No.
Okay.
So it was working before, but it obviously was low on ink.
Right. You replaced the ink, and then boom, it didn't work.
On a regular basis.
Yeah.
We're talking about you're clogging up the...
The first thing to do is go into that maintenance menu, and you'll see a number of different things you can do. Nozzle check, alignment check, and see if you can print even just a sample page. If you can print directly from the printer. Because that's what we're first trying to figure out. Is the printer dead or not?
We tried to do a copy, just copy something.
Yeah, but
put it under the lid.
Yeah,
hit copy.
Yeah,
nothing.
No, it doesn't respond at all.
It responds. It just a blank sheet of paper.
Yeah, so go into the maintenance menu and at least try some of these maintenance things. That's the most direct way. If you're printing a blank sheet of paper and you don't see an error message of any kind. there's a lot of things that can go wrong in a printer. And of course, the first thing to do is just make sure the printer's working. Then we can, if it is working there, then we can go back to the computer, reinstall the print driver, reinstall the connection, all of those things. But, you know, the Wi-Fi can go bad. If it's a Wi-Fi printer, the software can go bad. But first, let's make sure the engine's working. It sounds like it's not if you can't copy. But again, that's testing a longer chain. We want a shorter chain. We just want to see if I can say print a test page and see if a test page comes out. If it doesn't give you an error message, but it prints a blank page, make sure that those cartridges are in properly. I did you get Canon cartridges or did you get a third party's cartridges?
She got a third party.
So here's another possibility, and this is an unfortunate one. And I really hate to see this, but some printer manufacturers now do copy protection on their cartridges. They put a chip in their cartridges. HP is notorious for this. I don't know if Canon does this, but it's there. But if they did, the chip, I would expect that you'd get an error message. The printer would say, "You're not using our official cartridges," or whatever. But maybe it just wouldn't work.
The previous ones were purchased from the same company.
Okay, and they worked before, so that's good news.
Yeah.
Although, again, I got to point out, and it's really HP that we blame on all this, but HP sent out a firmware update that changed how their printer worked and required copy-protected chips or cartridges. They did that without changing the hardware, but I don't know that Canon did. In fact, I think Canon is not one of the companies that does that. I would try cleaning those heads. I would really try cleaning those heads a couple of times. There's a head cleaning or a nozzle cleaning routine. See if you can get any output at all. If it continues to give you nothing, then it could be that the print head has died. Now, I'm not sure on this particular Canon. On most Canon printers, when you replace the cartridge, you're giving it a new printhead. That's part of the cartridge replacement. And that's a good thing, but it may be that they're not related. I would do a deep clean from the maintenance menu, hope that that works. If it doesn't, you have, I would guess, a dead printer. And there's not anything you can do. So go into that maintenance menu and run some of those things. First thing to do is the easiest, which is print a test page. Do the deep cleaning on the nozzles. That's probably your next best thing. And if none of this gets any ink on the page at all, if you just continue to get blank white pages, it's dead, Jim. These things happen. Sorry, I can't give you any better advice, Dennis, but that's always the first thing to try with an inkjet. The good news about inkjets, they're not expensive. Mostly they charge you for the ink. So replacing an inkjet isn't the end of the world. On the other hand, because they are so inexpensive, they're not usually repairable. Not economically, anyway. Line one, Daryl from West Hollywood. Hi, Daryl.
Hey, I can't get you on the radio anymore. A week ago Friday, I turned on KFI, as a matter of fact, and all I was getting was really heavy static. And
your KFI stopped working?
It did.
How can that happen?
I know. I even checked other stations, and it was the same thing. I was getting nothing.
Oh, your radio's broken, dude. KFI's not broken.
No, that may be, but that would mean all three of them are broken, and they're broken in every room.
What?
In a condo. Yeah, I'm in a condo. I went to, they're remodeling a condo next door to me, so I went into that one, which is now empty, and workers are in there. And I plugged it in, and it's the same thing there. So I would assume it's the entire building. But
wow, I mean,
I don't know what to do? And that's
pretty.
Call, but you.
That's pretty significant. It worked. Did it work like you were able to get it absolutely cleanly and perfectly in the past?
Thursday it was fine. Friday a week ago, as I said, it was.
That is weird.
Yeah.
It almost sounds like, you know, it's conceivable if you had a lot of metal in the walls or whatever, AM reception wouldn't be very good, although AM really cuts through almost anything. The only thing I could think of that would have changed is if somebody's jamming it.
You mean like on purpose?
Yeah.
Way to do that?
Yeah. Call KFI's engineering department. Every radio station is required by their license to respond to community members who call with reception issues. Most of the time, that has to do with, I'm hearing your station in my fillings. But but this is something that the engineer, the chief at KFI, probably could help you with. He at least could give you some tips. He would know, first of all, if KFI has changed in any way. It doesn't sound like it because... other radio stations have the same problem, don't they?
Yeah, I checked other radio stations to see if it was the station or if it's the radio, and I wasn't getting anything on any station.
Yeah, that sounds like somebody in your apartment complex has some kind of massive, just bizarre. It would be absolutely illegal. And what would happen if you called the chief at KFI and he found out about this, he would call the FCC, and the FCC would send a van out. But
wow.
That would have to be a lot of noise to get what you're getting. That's kind of unheard of. But again, I don't know. Now, of course, KFI is listening right now, so maybe he'll call you. I don't know. I don't have a direct line to him. They're, of course, our mothership, our flagship station, but I don't have a direct line to him. Otherwise, I'd put you through.
Yeah.
But I'm not there on the facilities. That's got to be significant. Can you get it in your car?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Once I get out of the underground parking lot, I can.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember if it had been that way before or if...
I'm wondering, since you've got work going on next door, I'm wondering if they're running a compressor or something that is illegally jamming your radio. That's the only thing I can think of. There's something jamming your radio. Call the radio stations. If not KFI, they're nice guys, but if not KFI, whatever other stations you're not getting, and see if they can give you some tips, because that is not right. Something is making a lot of radio noise and blocking your reception. That's crazy. Highly illegal. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I want you to be able to hear us.
Absolutely.
That is wild. That is wild. I don't even understand that. I don't know how that could happen.
Well, leave it to me. I come up with these things all on my own that nobody else can answer. It never happened to them before, but it does to me. So
I mean, as a ham, you run into this. You run into noise sometimes, and that can come from a neon sign. If a neighbor just put up a neon sign, those things are really noisy. But it would have to be really violating FCC noise limits to do that.
Yeah.
It could be that the electric company did work outside and a transformer is now doing something
I called Southern California Edison thinking that maybe that was the case, and they assured me that no, that is not the case. I never heard of such a thing. But it's been going on for, well, more than a week now.
Definitely a call to KFI. And let me know, would you? Because I'm curious what it is. The nice thing, chief engineers at the radio station, if they've got the time, you know, sometimes they're jammed. But my experience with them is they're really very helpful. He'll be at least interested in what's going on, because that should, and it's absolutely illegal. It's a felony because you can't, you know, it means emergency radio is not working, things like that.
Yeah. Well, I somehow feel better.
I guess. So. Thank you, Daryl.
Okay. Thank you.
Are you a Bob Heil fan? No, somebody built a pine board transmitter. Is broadcasting next door? Could be. Could be. Hey, have a great day. Thanks for hanging on. I appreciate it.
Thanks.
All right. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go. And it's Don in Southern California. Hello, Don.
Hello, Leo.
Thanks.
I have a Lenovo Flex 15, the Costco version.
Yes, sir.
256 SSD and 1 terabyte SATA. On the SSD, except for Microsoft and Adobe programs, I want to move the remaining programs from my old HP laptop to the SSD, and also create a scratch drive for post-processing. Then I want to move the data only to the spinner. Any ideas about...
Yeah, data is not a problem. That's easy. You just copy it onto an external drive or even connect them and cannot copy directly. It's the moving of the applications that is always a problem.
Right.
And it has to do with the way Windows installs applications. They don't just put a file in the program and features folder, you know, that you could move over. They put a file there. They put a file here. They put dynamic linked libraries in this folder and that folder. They change registry entries. They add keys. And the problem is moving all of that in a way that actually is going to work is surprisingly challenging. There have been, over the years, a number of programs designed to move apps on Windows, uninstallers, things like that. You can try them.
Fortunately, the programs that I'm interested in are no longer available in any form.
That's when we get in problems, because otherwise you just download another copy, right?
Of course.
I don't have any experience with application movers these days. Let me ask the chat room, though. They're very good on this kind of stuff. If they have any application movers that they've used that they have had good results with. There are quite a few. There's Funduck makes one, FUNDUC. I wouldn't go and get a free one. You know, there's shareware ones out there. I'm not sure I would go out and get a free one. I don't know what the chat room thinks. The idea, I remember there used to be an uninstaller that I used that did this. The idea is a smart program can figure out. Normally, when a program installs on Windows, it actually creates a file called a manifest that says, here's what I did. And the uninstaller will use the manifest to reverse it. An application mover can use it to make copies of all of this stuff. But non-trivial thing to do, and inevitably stuff's not going to work. On the other hand, it sounds like it's your only option. So what I normally tell people is, you know, don't do this. Worst case scenario, you've got a non-working program and you would have that anyway, right? So maybe this will work for some stuff.
Okay.
Laplink, which is still around, of course, Laplink did this for years and they are still around. They still offer their Laplink was the company, remember, that made a cable, kind of a funky, weird printer. You remember that?
Weird. They have Laplink Gold.
Yeah, they still around and they have a PC mover, which does claim to do this. I would say that's probably your best bet.
Okay.
because they've been doing it for longer than anybody. It's not free, but it sounds like it's the only way you can get these old programs moved over. Just understand it's not going to be perfect, right?
Okay, yeah. Question. Is there a way to set defrag only to SATA on the Lenovo?
I don't know. I would guess that the defrag program, I haven't used defrag in more than 10 years. So I'm trying to remember. I would guess that the defrag would let you choose drives. But if it doesn't, turn it off. You can have a scheduler do it to the drive specifically. So if you're familiar with a Windows scheduler, which is all that does really is set a schedule up, you could either turn it on and then modify the schedule or then create a new schedule that say only defrag the C drive. You'd have to figure out what the defragger's command is, but chances are it's pretty straightforward. Otherwise, defragging, I don't defrag very, even with spinning drives, I rarely defragged. I would say there's no need to defrag unless you see some slowdown on the spinning drive. And what I probably would recommend is, whenever you think about it, no more than a few times a year, go ahead and defrag. Defragging is one of those voodoo processes that we all did in the old days. My car feels like it's faster after I get it washed. I know objectively it isn't running better. It's not faster because I got the car washed. It just feels that way. I think this defragging is a little bit like that. It makes you feel better psychologically. I don't think it's really necessary. Modern operating systems are pretty good at keeping stuff from getting too messed up. The idea of a defragger is in the old days, operating systems like DOS and Windows 95 weren't very smart. And when you move files around and put pieces here and there, just use whatever parts of the drive were free. And sometimes over time, your drive would get slow because it would take a while searching out the pieces of the puzzle on all over the drive. But a couple of things have changed. First of all, operating systems are much faster, much smarter, rather. You don't get that defragging problem as much because they try to keep sectors of the program and files together. The other thing that's changed is drives are so much faster. Even that spinning drive, as slow as it is compared to the solid state drive, is a lot faster than the drives of 15 years ago. So, defrag if you think of it. Running a defragger on a schedule, that's not necessary. That's voodoo. That's voodoo. I don't think it's really really necessary. Here's an article from Laptop Magazine on defragmenting hard drives. Wow. There's a lot of stuff people do that I don't know if I really recommend. For a long time, we had this debate. I would get in a debate with the chat room over whether you should clean your registry. I said, under no circumstances should you clean your registry. People hate the idea that there might be stuff in the registry from old keys, old data that no longer is needed, and I just want to get it out of there. Yeah, no. I think the dangers of cleaning your registry far outweigh the benefits. It's another one of those voodoo things. In the old days when operating systems were slow and dumb and computers weren't very good, We had to do a lot of things to keep it up to date and optimized. People even ran, this is kind of hard to believe, memory managers. Remember those? I'm not talking about QEMM, things like that, that would allow you to run multiple programs at the same time. I'm talking about memory managers you'd run that would defragment your memory and free up memory. And in the old days when operating systems were really bad and didn't do that automatically, maybe that made sense, but modern operating systems take care of all that stuff. I don't think you really need it. It makes you feel better. The problem with defragging too often is it actually can wear out the drive and cause drive damage and data loss. Just, by the way, just like cleaning your registry. The risks are far outweigh the benefits. Windows, look at this, from 2 years ago, Laptop Magazine, how and when to defragment your hard drive on Windows 10. I wouldn't. There is an automated defragger. Just turn it off. I think that's to make people feel better. I really do. Do you disagree? Let's talk. Or you can go to the website and leave a comment. TechGuyLabs.com. More of your calls still to come. Johnny Jett, just around the corner. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yes, it's time once again to travel around the world with Professor Johnny Jett. Hello, Johnny.
Hello.
I realize Johnny Jett sounds like one of those old cartoons that I watched growing up. You know, Johnny.
There was one called Little Johnny Jett, which I learned about much later. But I was getting Google alerts for this Little Johnny Jett, but I think it was in the 50s, and it was a cartoon plane. But I don't know who you're
Johnny
talking
Quest.
About.
Johnny Quest.
I don't know Quest. Johnny Quest. That's before my time.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Johnny Quest was an animated, very funny sci-fi kind of Hanna-Barbera thing. It was before your time. I don't think you were even born. It ran from in the mid-60s and then in reruns. Through the later years. Johnny Quest.
Well, I have been told I look like a cartoon character in the past.
I know that's rude.
Can you guess which one?
Mr. Peepers? I don't know who.
No, a girl one night told me I look like Barney Rubble in a bar.
You do not look like Barney Rubble. She was
and
just
I
being,
was like, Barney?
She was just being mean to you.
Well,
Johnny Quest is an 11-year-old American boy who lost his mother at an early age. Though unenthusiastic in his schooling, he is intelligent, brave, adventurous, generally athletic, with a proficiency in judo, scuba diving, and the handling of firearms.
Well, that is nothing like me, thankfully.
And then he and his special agent and bodyguard, Race Bannon, would travel around the world.
That is like me.
Yeah, yeah. So. I don't know. Ace Bannon is your wife, Natalie, I think. Yeah.
It could be.
So every week, Johnny joins us to help us travel better with technology. Travel like a rock star, as he says. Is that what you say, rock star?
Well, I'm a rock star, but on a, you know, a pauper's budget.
What is the name of the seminars you give?
Well, you always travel like a rock star, okay. But on a... you know, like, I don't know what kind of budget, groupies budget.
Do you still do those, or is that? I guess not.
I do, but I haven't that much lately.
Aha! Uh-huh.
So I'll change it up a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, you gotta keep it fresh. Anyway,
sure.
On this show, you're traveling like a rock star on a pauper's budget. What do you got for us?
So you know, I used to be afraid to fly, and I think you know that. So for you know, at least 3 years, I would not get on the plane between right out of high school until when went to college. I took 3 years off between college.
It's such and a good story because you have totally transcended that to the point where you spend more time in the air than on the ground.
Well, I do spend a lot, not more, but I do come close to it some weeks. But so there's an app called TurbCast, TURBCAST. It's iOS only. It's $1.99, and it's designed for people with mild cases of fear of flying.
Oh, turb as in turbulence.
Yes.
That's the scary thing.
Boy.
Yeah, that's a scary thing when you're flying around and the plane goes bump in the night.
Well, I used to be afraid of turbulence, and that's one of the things. And then British Airways actually offers a course that you could take in London in one of their simulators, a fear of flying course. So you can really learn about turbulence and realize that turbulence is just like going down a bumpy road in a Jeep. And there's nothing
you're
to
not
be afraid
of. You're not going to fall out of the sky.
No, but it's definitely fearful, especially when it's really rough turbulence. Fortunately, I haven't had that many times, and I've flown, you know, thousands of times.
So what is TurbCast, which is, by the way, the worst name I've ever heard.
And I was reading a roundup of some fear of flying apps, and I mentioned one before, which is the best one, SOAR.
Yes.
S-O-R-A-R.
Yes.
So, but I wanted to come up with a new one, and this one had okay ratings, and I heard and one of my friends said they used it and they liked it, so that's why I'm mentioning it now. I haven't used it. But what it does, it was created by a pilot, and it gives you the same aviation weather that pilots look at and gives you a realistic prognosis of if it's going to be bumpy or not.
Oh, so it kind of warns you ahead of time. You're going to have some bumps.
It does, but the coverage only works in USA, Mexico, Canada, UK, Western Europe, and a few countries in the Caribbean. It won't work if you're going to Asia or South Pacific or Australia or the Middle East or even parts of
I can tell you, I can do Leo's TurbCast for Australia. There is always turbulence on the
equator.
At the equator on the way to Australia. It just always is there. It's completely normal. Nobody gets in a uproar about it. Frequent flyers to Australia are used to it, and of course, so is the cabin staff and the But sure. if you know, I think you're right. If you kind of know, there's going to be some turbulence. Like in every time you land in Vegas, when you come in over the mountains, there's always a little turbulence.
Well, especially in the summertime when it's 110 degrees.
Yeah.
When it's hot out. And when you're going across the equator, it usually is turbulent. You know what freaks me out? Or sometimes over the North Atlantic when there's a big storm, when the pilot gets on and says, you know, flight attendants, take your seats.
I always worry. When I hear that, that's, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I always look at the flight attendant's eyes, and if I see that they're scared, then I get scared. But I think I've only once I've seen them scared.
If you see terror in your flight attendant's eyes, the problem is it's too late. There's nothing you can do. Just hold on tight.
Yeah, there's some Hail Marys.
They get scared too, though. Let's be fair. Flight attendants are not immune. Right?
No, I had a flight attendant friend who was afraid to fly internationally. She didn't want to fly on long flights.
See.
I don't know. I don't think she was afraid of turbulence, but I think she was afraid of being stuck on a plane for 20 hours, which, you know, some people are.
Yeah.
And I used to be too. And I prefer, by the way, if I'm going around the world, I prefer, instead of taking one long haul flight, I'd rather break it up. See more places and you have shorter flights.
That's probably good advice, although I'm flying straight. No, actually, I'm not flying straight to Japan. I'm going to stop in Seoul, Korea and go to the world's largest ice skating rink or something, right?
That's right. Yes.
Right?
Am I right? But you're traveling farther. You're going over Japan to get to Korea.
What?
So, yes.
What?
So you're not. Yes.
What? That's. Yeah, well, why am I doing that? I'll tell you. You know why? I'll tell you why. Because United, which flew directly from San Francisco to Osaka, was $5,000 more. That's why. I'm saving $5,000 by doubling back.
Yeah, well.
And by the way, Korean Air, it's supposed to be nice, right?
It is nice.
The new United Polaris, is that what they call their long haul?
Yep.
That's supposed to be very, very nice too. So I don't know.
That's nice, but the Korean will be better.
Are you going? Will it? Oh, good.
And if you're on the A380, they have a bar in the back.
That's all I need. Forget TurbCast.
Yeah, forget about that.
Martini cast. So yes. Micah in Maine, who's a big flight guy, he's on does some podcasts on flight and stuff. He wonders if you're going to be going to the Farnborough Air Show, the big air show coming up.
I am not. Which one is it?
This is the Paris Air Show, but it's in England. I guess they rotate.
Okay. Yeah. You know, I have not been to that.
Oh, you
and
should
I'm
go.
Not planning on going. I've been to a couple smaller air shows. I am an aviation geek. I'm just not a fanatic. But
he
I would love to go.
He's all about the travel, not about the plane, right?
No, I am about the plane too. I love the different planes.
Okay.
But I like to go to the Singapore Air Show and the Dubai Air Show, which just took place.
Well, excuse me. So we got about a minute and a half left.
Okay.
You want to give us a website too?
Sure. So last week I mentioned about an app about earthquakes because we had a relatively small earthquake here, 5.3. Not that small, but
right. It
was a good size. It shook everyone up. And on the news, I learned about a website which can be used for anyone because a lot of people are traveling to California or to places where there are earthquakes. And this website's called preparesocal.org. preparesocal.org, and it's by the Red Cross, so you know it has good information.
Oh, I like Red. Boy, just download every Red Cross app. They have so many, and they're all
and this
good.
Is not an app, but they do have apps just for the for every.
This is a website.
This is a website. preparesocal.org, and then it's /Red Cross Ready, and it gives you all different things to do. And one of them, you hit the earthquakes tab, and it tells you information that I think every person who comes to California or lives in California needs to brush up on it. I'm one of them because I was like, man, I forgot about that. Or I had misinformation when I was growing up. They tell you to go underneath a desk or whatever.
No, not anymore. No doorways, baby. No.
Yeah. So they tell you, like, drop, cover, and hold on. Move as little as possible. Some people just want to dart out of the building, and you don't do that.
Don't run out of the building. But do run to johnnyjet.com where you can sign up for Johnny's travel newsletter. And find links to great sites like this. PrepareSocal.org. Thank you, Johnny. Safe travels. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. You know who you are. But I think it's Henry from Prescott Valley, Arizona next. Hi, Henry. Thanks for hanging on.
How you doing, Leo?
I am great. How you doing?
I'm doing great. You have probably induced me to spend more money than anyone other than my wife. in that I am a client of Simply Safe.
Yes.
Carbonite.
Yes.
I have an Epson ET4250.
Yes.
I have pictures from Fracture.
Yes.
And I'm thinking of enrolling in ITPro.tv.
All right. You got the hat trick.
In addition to that, you have recommended certain products through the years, including the Heil Pro PR.
That's what I use. Are you a ham?
No, I
podcaster.
Use it for vocals.
Oh, you're a singer. Nice. All right.
And I have a Shure SM58 for my instruments.
Wow.
I have two ECHO views.
Oh, wow. You got to stop listening to that Leo guy. It's starting to cost you.
I also have a dot and a regular. I've also bought products recommended by Scott and Chris. So.
I would ask how you like all those things, but we only have 3 hours for the show, so I'll just presume you're happy. Oh, good.
I love them all.
Very good. Thank you. On behalf of our sponsors, I thank you. And, of course, I thank the sponsors because that's what keeps the show on the air. So I appreciate
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. I've had to stream you on twit.tv since I moved up here to Prescott Valley, which is paradise compared to KFI land, unfortunately. But
but you live in a beautiful part of the country, so
I sure
there you
do.
Go. Yep.
I am.
Is the desert blooming yet? Are you starting to see some?
We're starting to see some flowers.
Nice.
They're not here yet. We're not through winter yet.
I think spring in the high desert is just beautiful. Just beautiful.
It is. Yeah. It's gorgeous. Yeah. And we've got three different national forests around us. So we've got plenty of.
You moved to paradise. How's your internet up there?
It's good. It's very good. I get 100 megabytes.
That's fantastic. No megabytes. Yeah, that's fantastic.
Nope.
You know, it's very typical, unfortunately, that people who move to paradise lose internet access. And I think for many a fair trade, I don't think I could do it. So I'm glad you can go somewhere nice like Prescott Valley and still get good internet. That's good news.
Absolutely.
Yep.
In August, I'm attending something called the Americana Fantasy Camp, and I'm going to do six songs, three with a trio that I've been working with for about 6 years now, two with a new duet that I'm going to do called the Elderly Brothers.
Wake up, little Susie. It's time for your pills.
That's right. and one as a solo with two members of the Kingston Trio.
Oh, man. Are you kidding? Oh, what fun. So it's fantasy camp for folk singers.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
And this year I have to record some demos to go to the people I'm singing with so that they will be able to follow along with what keys we've got and things like that.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if there is a really good recording type program other than GarageBand that would work with that. And the reason I say other than GarageBand is because I've never used it and I'm not sure I understand it.
GarageBand actually, from a point of view of audio quality, that really doesn't matter. If you've got the right microphones and mixer and all of that, any program, even the free open source Audacity, will record basically the same bits. So, because they're all using the same stuff to convert it to bits. So that's not going to make a huge difference. It's really more what you can do afterwards. The nice thing about GarageBand, it has, you don't need to learn GarageBand to use it as a recorder. You already have it. Obviously, you have a Mac, right?
Right.
And you're talking about recording to a Mac, not an iPad?
No. Well, I could do it with any of them.
I've got
everything Apple.
All right. I think you already have GarageBand. They do offer, and it's fairly inexpensive, a step up from GarageBand called Logic. But if you find GarageBand intimidating, stand back. Logic's even crazier.
Uh-huh.
So there are simple recording programs that are fairly inexpensive on the Macintosh. For years, I used something called Amadeus, after Mozart, Amadeus mm-hmm. Pro. I think it's about $50. And then somebody turned me on to a program called Twisted Wave that is quite good on the Macintosh as well. I think it's under $100 for sure. And that's what I've been using lately. The beauty of Twisted uh-huh. Wave, it's very simple. You push mm-hmm. the round red button and it records. And okay. it has fairly nice editing stuff. I use recording all the time for radio, and I don't need anything fancy. I don't need multi-track. I'm just recording my voice. And so for those, even the free Audacity would be fine. Audacity is also available on the Mac. It's open source, and it's a little crashy. It's a little less reliable. I find Amadeus and Twisted Wave to be a little more stable. Both of them will do fine just recording demos. If you wanted multi-track recording, though, I'd say you might want to figure out GarageBand because it'll do that as well.
Yeah, I need two tracks. I'm going to do a guitar, rhythm guitar bottom, and then I'll do the vocals on okay. top of that.
Now, I'm going to tell you a system that somebody you might know who listens to this show uses in just a second. I got to take a break, though. Hey, our show today brought to you by actually really almost everything I do for the last 10 years or so. How long has it been? Brought to you by LastPass. First thing I do when I get into work, I log in to all my stuff through LastPass. I don't remember passwords anymore. LastPass is the one last password I have to remember. It generates long, strong, random passwords for every site, every app, every account. I even can store secure notes there, so I keep my passport and my driver's license, my social security numbers, all the stuff I want to keep super private. I keep them locked up in my LastPass vault, where I'm the only one who has access to it. It's encrypted, strong encryption, done right. And I know this because Steve Gibson looked at it. He sat down with the creator of LastPass, Joe Segrist. In fact, there's an episode of Security Now you can watch where he went through it step by step, and Steve said, yep, he's doing it right, and I'm using it, and I'm using it. I hope you're using it, too. If you're not, join over the 13 million people who are using LastPass to remember that password, that login, those special documents, to keep them safe. It keeps you from doing things that everybody agrees. Do you reuse passwords? Because it's hard to remember more than one, right? Don't. That's bad. Use LastPass. And what I love about LastPass is whether you're on Android, iOS, on Chrome, on Firefox, on Safari, on Edge, it'll automatically fill in the passwords for you. You get to a website, it's done. No typing. And no mistakes. LastPass. No matter where you are, LastPass is there for you. They simplified password management. And by the way, we use it. I don't just use it personally. We also use it, and this was Russell's decision, but I completely agree with him. We use LastPass Enterprise for the business. And you can have one account, one login on all my systems that gives me all the enterprise passwords, plus completely securely and separately and privately all my passwords. So I have one vault for everything. And everything's encrypted. AES 256, no man in the middle attacks. LastPass, whether it's LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family, LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or less, or LastPass Enterprise, there's a LastPass that's right for you. Honestly, if you do one thing to secure yourself this week, make it today. Make it LastPass. LastPass.com/twit. The number one most preferred password manager. Certainly is here at Twit in our Tech Guy show. LastPass.com/twit. Check it out today. We thank LastPass for securing my stuff and for supporting the Tech Guy podcast. Now back to work. We're back. We're talking to Henry Prescott Valley. He's going to, what's it called, the Americana Festival?
Americana Fantasy Camp. It's in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Oh, man.
Between August 8 and 12.
You know, my fantasy would be to go and just listen.
Do it.
I want to hear the Elderly Brothers, and I want to hear you sing with the Kinston Trio. Wow.
If you show up, I'll get you a free ticket.
All right.
And
wow.
I'll get dinner.
That sounds wonderful. What fun. I remember as a kid, my mom went to a folk singing camp in Upper New York State, and Pete Seeger was there, and we listened to Pete Seeger for days, and I just enjoyed it so much. So we're talking about recording now.
Uh-huh.
You, you'll be fine with what you've obviously got good equipment. You were talking about your microphone. You've got a Macintosh. You could even do this on an iPad. Twisted Wave, by the way, is available for iPad and Macintosh. Really nice program. That's probably what I would recommend. It'll let you do two-track recording, no problem at all. But I do know somebody who recorded an album, and I was kind of stunned. You heard of a bluegrass player? He's pretty good on the banjo, named Steve Martin, I think. You might have.
Oh, yeah.
You might have heard of him.
I have.
He did an album. He was in California. His partner, Edie Brickell, you might have heard of her. She was with the New Bohemians.
Yeah, I know her.
Paul Simon's
Absolutely.
Wife. Wonderful singer. Uh-huh. They did a bluegrass album called Love Has Come to You, I think it was called. And Steve told me that he recorded this. Get ready for this. This is how they worked. He would record the banjo track on his iPhone and send it to Edie so she could write the lyrics. And she'd record the lyrics and send it back to Steve. Now, I don't think that's the final track you heard on the album.
I'm sure.
I'm sure that they, after they perfected the song, then went into the studio and recorded it. But I found that fascinating that even today, for a professional, an iPhone and just recording, not a fancy mic, but just recording off the mic on the iPhone, was good enough for them to send tracks back and forth. That kind of surprised me.
That should work real well, because basically the purpose of these demos is just to let the other guys know what I'm going to be doing.
Just do that then. Yeah, play it for them, and then they can hear it. If it's good enough for Steve and Edie, and I don't mean Alan and Gourmet, then it's good. Then it's good enough, I'm sure, for the elderly brothers. Nice to talk to you. Have fun at your conference.
Leo.
That sounds great. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. The elderly brother. Wake up, little Susie. You got to do that one. Wake up. Wow. Oh, that sounds like a good time. I hope you have fun. That sounds so great, Henry. It's
going to be a great deal of fun. I've been practicing for a while, and I think we're going to knock them dead.
Wow. And you play the guitar?
Yes, I'm going to play 12-string, 6-string, and 4-string tenor guitars on the various songs.
See, even if you record it all fancy with Twisted Wave and you send it to them and everything, they're going to listen to it on their iPhone anyway.
Probably.
Right? I mean, so the microphone on today's smartphones is pretty darn good, and as long as you're careful about not over-modulating it, I bet you get certainly good enough for you to send them, here's what I'm going to be doing. And then, you know, if they say, well, you got to get it better, you could go out and get Twisted Wave.
All right. Sounds good.
My pleasure. Have fun.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Yeah, not Alan Lawrence. Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. Yeah, like
Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet.
Yeah. That's the original Steve and Edie. Yeah.
Right.
Nice to talk to you. Take care. I am Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Back to the phones we go. And on line one, we've got Nam from Lake Forest, California. Hi, Nam.
Hi, Leo. How are you?
Great. Thanks for hanging on. Welcome.
Oh, no, thank you. I took your advice. I bought a new router, a ASUS router.
Very nice.
And,
you like it?
Very nice. My daughter has no complaint about when she's playing game and I watch Netflix. It worked real good.
That's a good, because that's a challenge, because you're downloading a lot of content on Netflix and she needs very quick response for online gaming. So that's a good. Which ASUS did you get?
The AC3100.
Very nice. Yeah.
Yes. The problem I had the Apple AirPort before, new router, and my HP Laser Pro M277DW model.
Yep.
It connects to the router, but now my daughter can't print her homework from her laptop or tablet.
So on her laptop or tablet, does it see the printer?
It sees the printer, but somehow can't print from there. She can hook hardwire from the laser to her laptop. That's about it.
Yeah. What happens when you say it sees it? Does it see that actual printer?
Yes.
Yeah. And when she prints to it, what happens?
It just doesn't react to anything, doesn't do anything at all.
I hate printers.
Same thing with the tablet. I have a Samsung tablet,
yeah.
And it won't print. but they have the HP, I forget what's that, the little...
Well, yeah, here's what I would suggest. Because you changed the router, it's probably a good idea to go into the printer.
Okay.
And delete the old connection and create a new connection. And make sure it's on, you know, the same network as your daughter's, obviously. And now with this new router, you might have a guest network and other networks. So I would start over and reset the all the settings for that printer. And then... if that doesn't work, then go into your daughter's computer, delete that print driver. You could do that in the control panel. Yeah, you already did that. Yeah, update the printer first, then if you need to, do that again. Sometimes, even though, hey, it's Wi-Fi, it should just still work. You see it, but it might be some sort of control system that's not working. It might be the print spoolers left over from the previous printer, and it's trying to print, and then somehow there's something different. Tablets generally, is it a Apple tablet? Yours is a Samsung, but what's your daughter's? Is it an iPad?
Apple.
Yeah.
I'm only one that oddball.
So I would check to see if the printer supports Apple's AirPrint technology. If it does, then that's probably a preferable way anyway to print to it. And on your Samsung, you should check if the HP supports Google Cloud Print and then use that. Both of those are designed to work a little bit more reliably with tablets and printing.
I see.
Yeah, and most modern printers will support both Apple's AirPrint and Google's Cloud Print.
Okay.
And it may be, out of sync's pointing out, that even though you see the name, one of the things that happens when you get a new router is you get new IP addresses for everything. And so the IP address has almost certainly changed for the printer. And since Windows is really identifying it, despite what it appears to be identifying it by name, it's actually identifying it by internet address, IP address, it'd be probably a good idea to just reinstall for the printer as well as the computer. All right?
Okay. Thank you.
Have fun.
And you have a good trip.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for helping me out here.
Okay.
Have a good one. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Fred Upland, Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for hanging on. What can I do for you?
Well, before we actually get started, I want to tell you that my wife has a commercial embroidery business, and the operating system on the machine, which is only 5 years old, has DR-DOS on it.
It's one of those automated embroidery machines?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, those are really cool because you basically make a design on the computer – and you just send it to the machine. It goes and prints it. It's a printer, really, right?
Yeah, it is. And it thinks that it's running a paper tape with holes.
Who's the manufacturer, out of curiosity? Do you know?
SWF, but they're all based on Tajima.
Yeah. I've seen these. They're really cool because they're, you know, it's basically printing in thread with a needle. But it's a really cool idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's actually 3D because you're actually raising up whatever you're doing. It's pretty interesting.
That's a hoot, though. It's DR-DOS, which was a digital research competitor to Microsoft DOS, really dates back into the 80s. So even though the embroidery unit is only 5 years old, it's got a 30-year-old operating system it's using. Wow. Hey, it works.
Yeah, we can't complain about it. So my question for you, though, is I called you when Plume was pre-release.
Yeah.
I had purchased the product. We talked about a couple of other mesh networks. What I was primarily trying to solve was coverage in the house, but also latency on the network. And the coverage problem is solved, but the latency problem is still there. And I had a Verizon DSL set up, and I've disconnected all of that, so none of that is operating. And I still get intermittent latency, and I really don't know what to look for to stop that. And it could be like anywhere from 1 to 5 minutes that...
What?
Network...
That's not latency. That's died and went to heaven. We talk about latency in milliseconds, and a good latency is 10 thousandths of a second. So you're talking several orders of magnitude slower. That's a big deal. That's not latency. That's like I'm not responsive. Now, when you say that, let me ask how you measure it, first of all.
Well, it's mostly on our computers here. I have five computers connected, two cell phones, a tablet.
Yeah, and so how when it's latent, what is the symptom? How do you know it's latent?
I'm trying to connect to one of the computers to get a file off of it, and it sits there and waits, and it can be anywhere from a few seconds to a number of minutes.
Okay. But when you're for instance, if have you ever used something like a bandwidth tester? Like I personally like the DSL reports bandwidth tester. Have you ever tried that? It will tell you it's internet latency, and that's what the plume is concerned with. Generally, is you know how fast your connection on the internet latency is delay basically. So. Is that a problem, or is it just in the house latency?
Well, you know, that's what I'm not sure of. I've done the network test. I have. Yeah.
If you do a speed test.
I have direct way.
Yep.
And it can, you know, I have.
Well, satellite internet is notoriously latent. So because you're on a satellite dish, right?
Yes.
That's not going to infect your in-house. Oh, well, actually, it will affect your in-house latency. I think you may have found the source of this. So, when you're doing file sharing on your internal network, one would assume that you're talking. The machines are talking directly over the network, but in fact, what I think is happening is they're talking over direct way. So when you're connecting to that machine, it's connecting all the way up to the satellite, all the way down from the satellite to the internet. All the way back from the internet to the satellite and all the way to the other device. No wonder you're getting 1 to 5 minute latency. So that's the problem right there. That's not the plume can't fix that. We're going to have to take a break, but hang on the line. I'm going to talk about some of the solutions you can solve. That's pretty typical of a satellite internet. What you want to do, though, is file sharing that doesn't use the internet. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, I had to stop there. But yeah, so that's, I think when you're seeing that kind of latency, it's because the file sharing is going through the public internet.
Okay, yeah. So I thought I would solve that by getting rid of the DSL network. I kept it as a backup, but I was still getting the problem, and I just didn't understand why.
That's my guess. Now, it is possible. That's, by the way, I think the default, if you just do file sharing, it will use the public internet. So instead of connecting, as you would think, right over the LAN, it's going out to the internet, and then coming back. And on, and that's that would completely explain the kind of latency you're seeing. You shouldn't see anywhere. You obviously should see very much less latency if you're sharing directly over the LAN.
Yeah, because I have DirecTV. I don't have BIOS or any.
Yeah, you may not. Satellite internet is notoriously latent. That's just what happens with satellite internet.
Yeah, and I've got 7 TVs connected to DirecTV, so it's, that's a issue also.
What you want to do is look how you can do your file sharing on the LAN, not using the internet. In other words, if you completely disconnected the internet, if you turned off the Hughes net or the direct net and had no internet, that would break your file sharing because you're going out through the cloud. So what you want to do is share it over the LAN completely locally. And I don't unfortunately have time to walk you through that. But if you go to, I think simplynetworked.com would have a tutorial. Mm-hmm. On that, what you want to do is find out how do I set up my my file sharing so that it's not using the public internet.
Okay,
that'd fix it. So it's not the plume in this case. I've had the same problem. It's easy to do this because that's the default. Is go out because you give it an IP address. So it says, I'll go find that.
Yeah,
and it takes a while. 1 to 5 minutes. Wow, that's useless.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to run a business here.
What is it? Is it Practically? Maybe it's Practically Networked. I think it's practicallynetworked.com. Let me see. Yeah, practicallynetworked.com. And you're going to want to look at LAN file sharing. And let's see if they have that. Yeah, 12 tips to cure network file sharing problems. That should do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
That'll give you some tips on how you could do this without going through the internet.
Okay. Yeah. I was just really, perplexed as to, what the problem was.
Well, you'll know if you completely disconnected your internet access, like just had it just be a LAN without going out to the outside world, you would no longer have file sharing. If my deduction is correct.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are ways to force it to be local. Okay?
Yeah. All right. Sounds great. Thanks.
All right. Take care. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And let's see. Let's go back to the phones. And Jeffrey from Las Vegas has been very patient. Thank you for hanging on, Jeffrey. What can I do for you today?
You're welcome. I'm sorry, Leo. You're welcome.
Thank you.
I went from a Huawei with an AT&T company, and now I'm with Sprint with a Galaxy S8.
Okay.
My Gmail is IMAP. Okay. I double-checked that, make sure it wasn't POP3.
Okay.
And what happens is if I delete Gmail on my phone, it does not delete on the cloud or the computer and vice versa. So my phone has like 1,000 emails that I would have to delete individually, even though they've already been deleted on my computer, which is much easier to do.
So this is an IMAP thing. And the whole point of IMAP is that the official mail is stored at Gmail. And you just have a view of it using a Gmail app on your phone, or even if you're using any other app on your phone. Now, what is supposed to happen is, but generally it's a setting, and it may not be on by default, is that if you delete mail on a client on the IMAP server, you can have it be, they call it expunged, to distinguish it from kind of standard deletion, but you can have it expunged on the server as well. But usually you go into the settings for your email client, that is the email program on your phone, and you say, when I delete a mail locally, I want you to delete it on the server. That's not the normal case, because IMAP IMAP's totally designed for your system, your setup, which is that you might have multiple clients and you want that there to be one consistent server with the same email so that all of them have the same view, right? So in general, when you delete it locally, it's not going to delete it on the server because they don't know, well, maybe he still wants it on the other phone or the computer. So that you have to say specifically.
Okay. I think all the boxes were correctly checked, and I noticed that.
So you're sitting on your phone and you delete just a single email?
Well, yes.
And it doesn't get reflected on the server, on Gmail. It's still in the inbox where it was.
Well, it'll be deleted on the phone. Well, I'm more concerned about deleting an email using my computer.
Oh.
And I would like that deleted on the phone. And
yeah.
I understand it would have to be deleted on the server.
No, you don't really have a copy on the phone. It just seems like you do. You have a cached copy. So this is where the confusion comes from, because people think about the old email system, POP3, and in that case is exactly how it worked. You'd have a server, your phone would download a copy of the mail, whether or not it deleted it on the server, and if you wanted to delete it, you'd have to delete it everywhere it existed. That's not so with IMAP. So all you have to do, if you've deleted on the server, if you go to your Gmail account and you delete it, you refresh the phone, it should disappear on the phone.
Well, it's not, so I'll look at a setting, and maybe there's a POP3 setting on the phone.
You could be using POP3.
Go to IMAP and set.
Yeah, you could be using POP3 on the phone. So what client, what email program are you using on the phone?
Gmail.
Yeah, Gmail doesn't – the Gmail app on the phone should never have this problem because it's really, I mean, it's not, I don't think it's doing much at all. I think it's really almost just a web view. So I'm wondering if maybe there may be a communication.
10 years, I've never had the problem with other phones. It's just this new S8.
Yeah. Are you not using the Samsung? It's the Huawei phone that you're using?
No. The Huawei works perfectly.
It's the Samsung.
The brand new Samsung S8 on Sprint.
Make sure that you're not using Samsung's email client. In fact, Samsung provides a Gmail client. It may well be they've tweaked it, made it better, as in worse. So that could be an issue. One thing you could do is disable the Samsung Gmail client and download a new version from the Google Play Store. Make sure you've got the real official Google client. And then I would look in the settings. If you're using the Gmail app to look at your Gmail, it should reflect exactly whatever you do on the web directly on the phone, unless for some reason you've changed a setting to say cache the mail or something like that. I don't even know if you can. Go to the Google accounts and make sure that sync is set up for Gmail and that sync is specifically checked. The box is specifically checked with the Gmail client because that should be synced exactly to what's on the Gmail.
Could I ask one related question,
sure.
Which is, you say Gmail is free, thus no tech support. Does Google have a pay number? I can give them a credit card and I can bill my telephone account where I can get tech support.
No. They give support. It's just not perfect. If you pay for G Suite, if you pay for a Google account, which a lot of businesses do, you get better support for sure. Then you get the G Suite support. If you're a Google Fi customer, you get better support. If you have a paid service with Google, you will get better support. But all you're going to get for the free stuff is an online chat, and the quality of support will vary depending on who's on the other end of the chat. I am convinced, by the way, on these online chats, that at least some of the time you're not even talking to a human. That certainly at the beginning of the chat, you're getting canned responses from a computer that at some point a human might take over. So, good. In other words, there. As far as I know, there. I don't. Anybody know? Does Google offer paid support? I think you have to actually buy a Google service like G Suite, and you may not want to do that because all the people I know who use G Suite complain bitterly that when they use their G Suite account, they don't get the same features as the free users. Oddly enough. So,
I can buy G Suite and then cancel it after I get my answer.
Try the chat and just be patient. And if you don't get a good answer the first time, do it again and you'll get maybe a different robot and you'll get something better. We had a caller, remember that? A couple of months ago who actually, she lived in Irvine and went to the Google campus in Irvine and knocked on the door. And no, and they said, reminded me of the Wizard of Oz. Go away, nobody gets to see the wizard, no way, no how. It was a very strange thing to do. She eventually got her problem solved. She got locked out of her Gmail account, but not by going to the door of Google. All right, now chat room has got a lot of good suggestions. We're going to put those at techguylabs.com. Let's see here. Check your Gmail setting on the Gmail page. Make sure all your forward pop IMAP settings are correct. That's for sure. That's where it says IMAP and pop settings on the website. You want to make sure that you're using IMAP and not pop by accident. Pop would do that, by the way. It would leave a copy on your phone. And it may be, Samsung does strange things. It may indeed be that Samsung has done something a little odd. I'll have to look at my S9 and see. I immediately disable all of the apps I don't use, which includes the Gmail app on the S9. You can't delete it, but you can disable it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More to come in just a minute. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls here. Let's see. We've got going to Akron, Ohio. Mark on the line. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Leo. Thank you for taking the call.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
Yes, so I know one of your recent callers on your radio show asked you about all-in-one computers.
Yeah.
So I had a question about similar idea, a little more detailed, I would say.
These are like the iMacs where the screen and the computer are all mushed together into one device. People like them because they're elegant looking. They eliminate a lot of wires. It's a good looking computer for a visible place. You know, it's not nearly as flexible. You can't, you know, often can't expand them or add on to them. But I think Apple really made the all-in-one almost the default. And for, you know, desktop computing. And so a lot of other manufacturers make them too. So what is it about the all-in-one that attracts you?
Yeah, well, all of those things you said, actually, the Apple, they also, even their, many of their desktops are, the ones that are not all-in-one, have very small computers, which are kind of do a similar thing. But what attracts me primarily is the fact that it's one piece, right. less the better, basically. Less wires, less pieces.
I remember I got the first iMac, and it was amazing because you take it out of the box, you'd plug it in, and you're done. You know, I mean, it doesn't, you have wired mouse and keyboard, you plug that in, but with Bluetooth, you don't even need to do that. And it really is a gorgeous look. But the drawbacks are it's not expandable. They're often not as fast as you know, towers because, you know, you got to, it's like a laptop, basically. You got to consider heat and cooling and all of that stuff.
Right. So that my question is, I'm looking to get one. I'll tell you what my usage is, and I want to hear your professional guidance and advice.
All right.
So I have regular office use, primarily, you know, for the most day on a regular day-to-day basis. You know, simple, just documents and whatever and whatnot and browser. But then, I mean, there's occasional or more than occasional, definitely a couple of times a week where I'll be using a little more of a sophisticated programming, Photoshop, Premiere Pro, for a small, just in-house design, a small video editing, Publisher. So programs that will need a little bit more of some power to it. And I found problems when I've been using computers that didn't have this speed. Now, I know there's what I've been always been told was there's a few elements which are important. Is having a solid-state drive.
Yep.
Of course, and what level, like if it's an i7, i5, whatever. I'm talking Windows here because that's the one I use.
Yeah, faster processor is usually good, although, again, because of the thermal constraints on all-in-ones, unless the thing is really well cooled, you may not get the benefits of the i7. A lot of i7s are so hot, and this is certainly the case in laptops, that the thermal issues mean they can't run at full speed. And so a lot of times, you know, you're overbuying when you buy an i7 and a laptop. And I think that's probably true on some Windows machines as well. You really want cooling to be very good on an all-in-one.
Interesting. And then there's a processor speed of, you know, the gigahertz and all that. So I was wondering.
Yeah, so you'll notice, like they'll say on a lot of Intel chips, they'll say, you know, the nominal speed is 2.2 gigahertz with the speed step all the way up to 3.8. But if it's too hot, it won't get to 3.8. It'll stay around 2.2 gigahertz. So a lot of times that's misleading. And often I tell people, you don't need an i7. You need more RAM. You didn't mention RAM, but you do need more RAM.
RAM, yeah, of course.
Yeah, very, very important.
Solid state versus RAM, which one is more important?
Well, if you're doing Photoshop, probably you probably want the RAM. They both help a lot. I mean, it just not everything needs a lot of RAM. If you get RAM is the fast memory that the program's living in, but if you're doing Photoshop, for instance, the photo has to live in there too. And so large, you know, I have 42 megabyte raw photos coming off my camera on my Canon. So I need that amount of space in RAM plus a couple of extra scratch copies. It adds up pretty fast. So Photoshop eats RAM like crazy, but also Google Chrome eats RAM like crazy, and more RAM will help there. I'd say if you have 8 gigabytes, if you're getting 8 gigabytes, you're probably fine. If you can afford 8 gigabytes and an SSD, do it.
Yeah, so here's what I found one, which just, again, my price budget was just roughly the $1,000 range, and I found a Lenovo. It's the Idea Center 510.
I love those.
Part of the include was they have different, obviously different ones that they come in the 510. The one that I found has got an i7, 8 gigabyte RAM, 2.8 gigahertz of processing speed, and a terabyte of regular hard drive, and then 128 gigabyte of SSD.
That's actually not a bad way to go. That, and I'll tell you why they like to mix it like that, because solid state drives are more expensive per gigabyte, so they don't get as big often. The prices have dropped, so it's not as big a problem as it used to be. But, you know, you can easily fit Windows in all the applications you use. You can almost certainly fit that into the 128-gig SSD. And those are that's where speed matters, in boot time and loading the applications time. I often do that. I keep my data. You can keep your data on a slower drive, a larger capacity slower drive, as long as the programs and the operating system are on the solid-state drive. That'll give you 99% of the benefit.
So when I'm downloading a program, I should do it onto the SSD part.
You will anyway. Windows doesn't give you much of a choice.
Well, they allow you. I mean, I think they allow you to do it on either one, I believe.
It's rare that Windows will let you install a program into anything but the C drive, which is going to be your solid state drive.
Right.
So you're pretty much going to be. But that's fine. That's what you want. You would. There are very few programs. Usually they're portable programs that don't require living in the Windows directory. Very few programs that will not launch install on C. So that's why your C drive, your first drive, your boot drive has to be big enough to hold not just Windows, but all the apps you need. But you know what? 128 gigs is, I'm sure, enough. The only, maybe sometimes you'd run out of space if you installed giant games. Because games can be 40 gigabytes. They can be huge. Yeah. If you're not a gamer,
I'm not a gamer.
128 is plenty. Yeah.
One more quick question. What would you suggest for the most, just for a basic antivirus?
I wouldn't suggest it. Don't get an antivirus.
Not at all.
No. Well, you're getting one with Windows 10. You're getting Defender. Not the best in the world, but not the worst either. Here's the problem with all antiviruses. They open holes on your system. And, in fact, we've seen this happen with even the big-name antiviruses. Oh, we got an exploit on there. Oops, turned out the antivirus let the bad guys in. And add to that the fact that no antivirus is better than 50% accurate, and they don't do anything on brand-new zero-day exploits. We call them zero days because they're bugs that are discovered in the wild, essentially. They came out the same time as it was discovered, which means the antivirus company didn't have time to prepare for it. It's going to take them a few days. These things spread like wildfire nowadays. So most antiviruses, for instance, I'll tell you about the WannaCry ransomware. Of course, everybody's running antiviruses. Only about a third of the antiviruses stopped WannaCry. That means two-thirds of the people thought they were safe, and they weren't. So let's see. Antiviruses open the door sometimes for viruses. That's bad. They let viruses through because they don't know about them in many cases. That's bad. Gives you a sense of false sense of confidence. That's bad. And add to that, slow your system down, often get in the way of normal operations. Frequently, people will call me and say, I can't get online. It'll turn out it's security software blocking it. I don't think antiviruses are a good idea. I don't recommend them. On Windows 10, and if you have an older version of Windows, if you install Microsoft's Security Essentials, that's all you need. It comes with Windows 10, Windows Defender. It's not perfect, but it does the job it needs to do. Anything else is frankly going to make your system less reliable, not more reliable. When it comes to security, the most important thing is you update your system, update anything, every bit of software that goes online or has anything to do with going online, including Adobe Reader and Flash and your browsers and all that. Make sure those all keep up to date. Nowadays, everything updates automatically. Don't get in the way. Let those things update. Then that's job one. Job two, don't accept candy from strangers. Don't click links in email. Don't click links in Messenger. Only install programs you said, oh, I got to get this, and you went and you got it. If a pop-up comes on the screen saying you need this, that's bad. Don't do it. That's all you need to do. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, coming up in just a second, Dick DiBartolo, our Gizwiz. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, and now it's time for Disco with Dick. Hey, that would be a good show, Disco with Dickie D.
Disco with Dick, I love it.
Sounds like fun. That's Dick DiBartolo, Mad Magazine's maddest writer, and as Michael Cozio knows and makes fun of every week, he's a disco fool. But you don't still dance disco. There's nowhere you can go in New York to dance disco.
There is a bar called The Monster that has old-fashioned disco on Tuesday nights.
That would be kind of fun. Have you gone?
I have gone hundreds of times.
Oh!
Well, over the years.
How fun!
All the old disco.
Do you wear the old... clothes, like the bell bottoms and the satin
shirt? No, I just have old clothes. They just, it's the one place I go where they fit in.
That's all you have anyway, right?
That's all I have. I get tired of people go, what are you going to a disco? And I go in there, they think I'm really cool.
Yeah, wow, yeah. Dick, you dressed up for the occasion.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So Dickie joins us every week, not to talk about disco, although we do like to talk about disco, but mostly to talk about gizmos. He's the giz whiz, the gizmo wizard. And what have you got for us?
Well, you know what? Do you fall prey to, sometimes they're great buys. Do you get those deal of the day emails or do you block them all out?
Well, I don't pay attention to them, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So deal of the day turns out to be that this stack-on drawer system, 24 drawers. What's different about this one is it says that the drawers have a little locking mechanism. So, that you know, it's to throw in little parts. And nails and screws.
Oh,
and
you know what? I recently, my office at home is,
I can
where,
imagine.
Yeah, is where I bring stuff from here to clear this out. I bring it home, but eventually it's like Fibber McGee's closet, where if I opened the door to my office, everything would come tumbling out. So it was at the beginning of the year, actually, a couple months ago. As my New Year resolution, I said, I can't take this anymore. So what I did is I got a bunch of, maybe this is the same, stackable drawers, and I labeled them. I got one of those Brother labelers, and I said, you know.
Oh, wow, you really did.
Micro USB cables, USB 3.1 cables, chargers, all of that stuff. Is that what this is?
Okay, well, this is sort of an unhappy ending to mine.
Oh.
It could be the same
company. You
ordered
company. These?
The company is called Stack-On, and they make tons of storage devices, but I never saw one with this locking tab in the front. So, and it was deal of the day.
Yeah, they make gun safes and stuff. I mean, they make serious stuff.
Everything. Yeah, so yeah. I figured how, and it was half price, $15, 24 drawers. So I get it, and when you pull the drawer out, it's really hard to get it past the stop that they put there. And I figured that's okay.
That's but so then it doesn't come flying out.
Flying out. Or as you probably happened, you tilt it forward because you're trying to get something in the back.
And
then all 50 drawers come sliding out.
Yeah.
Okay. So the problem here is it is so hard to open the drawer that you must bolt this down or hold it back with one hand while you pull,
or you pull it off the wall.
Right. Oh, you're right. You're right.
Okay.
Or I pulled the drawer completely out of the unit by the time. But Leo, and this is knowing that the company makes all this, I turn it around and I think, well, this is a joke. They must have sent me something by mistake. Until I went on Amazon and everybody, when you have these little drawers,
yeah,
the track goes all the way to the back of the device.
Yeah.
This device is 6 inches wide. The track is 1.5 inches long. Turn the unit around. I actually put a picture up on my website. You turn the unit around, the drawers empty are drooping down because there's no track to hold them.
Oh, my gosh.
Someone said, when you put stuff in it, the drawers don't even open because they droop into the drawer below it.
Oh, this is not a good choice.
Anyway, so if you see Stack-On, you do not want the locking Stack-On. The thing looks great when I saw it in the picture.
It's pretty. It's black and yellow.
Pretty.
And 18 drawers, $15.
Yes, the bottom drawers are very wide. But then when I found out the...
Do you have a one-take video of this thing falling apart?
Yes, I do.
So Dick makes these great videos. So this was now we know why it was a deal of the day.
Deal of the day. Exactly. It's still on Amazon. It's $20. It's 30, but it's $29 on it. There I am trying to pull the drawer open. And as you see, you must hold the unit.
It's very secure.
Screw it down.
Unless it's not.
Unless it's not. It does have a little tab.
I guess the idea is that they won't just – you want it to be a little bit hard to pull out.
No, that part is fine. Yeah. But I'm not quite sure why they decided to make the tracks in the back so short. And it got 3.3 stars on Amazon, which is not
– I always good. Read – I think this is a good advice. I always read the reviews on Amazon before I buy anything.
You know, I do, except – I now go into read all reviews and then the little button that says make selections as to what reviews you want to read and click verified.
But that's good advice because that means they definitely bought it, right?
They bought it. And a couple of weeks ago, there was this a smoke detector, CO detector for $30. It had 50 five-star reviews. I clicked verified only, zero reviews. Zero reviews.
What does that mean? Does that mean the manufacturer was pushing reviews?
It meant that they somehow got 50 people to say they loved it.
But
and
not 50 people who bought it.
Not 50 people bought it. And I'm happy to say a week later, it just shows up as unavailable. We never know when this will be back. And all the reviews are gone.
Oh. So maybe some. Yeah, I think Amazon, if they catch you.
I think, yes.
They will be mad at you. And you don't want Jeff Bezos to get mad at you.
No, sir.
He is a notorious spanker. All right, Dickie D. So you say don't get this stack on thing.
No.
What should I get?
All right. So I, as a stopgap draw, I bought something. It was just $10 on Amazon, and it's called the Junk Draw Organizer with removable tray. I think I have a link to it on my website.
This is exactly what I was doing, junk drawer organizing.
Yes, but this one has 15 pockets with a sliding tray on the top. So it doesn't cover over everything, and you get additional space, and it still fits in a drawer. So right now, this is an easy place. I'm throwing in little USB cables. I have
That's what I had to organize. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Exactly. I have a ton of cables for the back of my modem, T cables and headphone jacks and splitters, all the stuff that you have, except you have 10 times more and yours are labeled.
Well, and I was worried about the exact same issue you had. So I actually got mine at Target I wanted to try it to see, and they still, it's like one of their essentials lines, right? And I'm looking at it. They're not expensive. They're plastic. They're probably not as attractive as what you use. And you can buy them online too. But I think it's good to go look at it. And I wanted something.
I do. Yes, yeah. And try it.
Yeah, and try it. I got mine at Target. But I found like they really.
You bought some big stuff.
Well. Yeah, these aren't I got some little drawers, but exactly the same purpose, which is to get. How many micro USB cables do you have? They're endless.
How about USB drives? How about
thumb drives?
How about thumb drives?
I get a double wide drawer for that. Dick DiBartolo, go to gizwiz.biz. That's where he hangs his hat. And make sure you check out the Gizwiz Visits the Tech Guy section. And of course, listen to his podcast at gizwiz.tv and play the What the Heck Is It contest for a chance to win an autographed copy of Mad Magazine. Thank you, Dickie D.
Thank you, sir.
Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.